Hey, Zach.
And welcome to Friday Night Feel. I should come up with a little theme song. That was pretty weak, Patrick, but that's all right.
We need an accompaniment.
Yes. And a little dance number, a little jazz hands. So welcome to Friday Night Feels. I am Patrick Nett, licensed mental health counselor and certified life coach. And Friday Night Feels is a show that focuses on a variety of wellness-related issues such as mental health, wellness, stress management, men's health, relationship issues, mindfulness, and much more. The focus of the show is to create connection and to be able to talk about issues that affect all of us and how to be the healthiest versions of ourselves that we can be. Each show, I invite a guest to join me to discuss their experiences with healing, wellness, and personal development. And my esteemed guest today is a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Mara Tesler-Stein. So welcome to Friday Night Feels.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting
Yay!
me. Yay.
Now, I'm just going to share a little bit of your feedback so that they know how amazing and wonderful you are, as I already know. Mara is a clinical psychologist and EMDR consultant and trainer in Chicago and Jerusalem. She is the founder and director of the Touchstone Institute for Perinatal Training, where she offers advanced EMDR trainings, which take deep dives into the intersections and applications of EMDR therapy and perinatal mental health. As senior faculty with the Institute for Creative Mindfulness, she also offers foundational EMDR trainings for perinatal specialists. And this is going to be one of the things that we focus on in our conversation today is her own personal journey with perinatal trauma, which she experienced 27 years ago, taking her through infertility, twin pregnancy, prolonged hospital bed rest, the NICU, and years of raising NICU graduates. So welcome back to Friday Night Feels, Mara.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yay. So we had you come on before and we were talking about different issues of couples and EMDR and all of that, but I really wanted to have you come back and really do a kind of like you said in your bio, a deep dive into let's look at the perinatal world a little bit more. How does that sound for you?
I love to talk about that stuff.
Hey,
Let's do it.
so your journey started 27 years ago, is that correct, with your
27
pregnancy?
years ago. Yep.
Okay, so could you share a little bit of what that looked like?
Sure. I was a new grad, clinical psychologist, just starting out. And my husband and I decided, okay, it's time to start a family. And instead of it going like it goes in the fairy tales, where, you decide to get pregnant and boom, you're pregnant. Instead, it did not go like that. And so we embarked on a journey of infertility, which culminated in a twin pregnancy, which, the reproductive endocrinologists are never thrilled about that, because it's a high-risk pregnancy. It's
Okay.
certainly not the highest risk pregnancy of multiple gestation, but they always like one baby, one uterus. Like
Okay.
that's the ratio they prefer.
Okay.
But we were happy. I thought, this is great. I get to catch up a little bit. You get a twofer.
Right.
And the pregnancy went great until about 24 weeks when I went in for a regular checkup and doctor said that I was in preterm labor. I was
Oh,
starting
wow.
to dilate in a phase, and they sent me up to the labor and delivery unit of the hospital where, my world very abruptly changed. They put me on a fetal monitor and a contraction monitor, and I was contracting about every 8 minutes.
Oh my
And I
goodness.
did not leave the hospital for 68, 6.5 weeks,
Oh my
45 days.
gosh.
Yeah, and it was really intense and it was really scary. And I remember feeling very isolated and crazy, like really crazy, because the anxiety was really overwhelming. That I was 24 weeks pregnant, which is just about the cusp of viability, meaning, much earlier than that, and they wouldn't have even really resuscitated babies
Right.
born. Now we're resuscitating babies born at 22, 23 weeks. Still very, very tentative, very fragile. It's very much cusp of the ability to survive. And then at 30 weeks gestation, meaning 10 weeks early, pregnancy is 40 weeks long, they were born.
Wow.
And they spent more than 10 weeks in the NICU, which was its own being dragged behind the roller coaster. People always talk about ICU as being a roller coaster. No, it's like being dragged behind a roller coaster.
Okay.
Roller coaster, being in the roller coaster would be better.
Great. And was that in the same hospital or did you have to?
It was the same hospital, fortunately. Okay. They did not need to be transferred to a children's hospital. And the hospital where I gave birth had a level 3 NICU, which meant that they could handle babies. Had they been born at 24 weeks, they could have cared for them adequately. They had the skill and the equipment that they would have needed. But fortunately for all of us, I was able to continue to be pregnant. You know, it's like, hey, Mar, how are you? Still pregnant.
Right.
that's the good news answer, you know, still pregnant. So 30 weeks is way better than 24.
Right. And how did your husband deal with that? Thinking couples dynamic of totally. 27 years ago.
Yeah. So this was our first pregnancy.
Okay.
And he happened to work about 10 minutes from the hospital.
Okay.
So, and it was, the hospital was about a half hour from home, just to give you the geography. Right. Because what that meant was that he could come by very easily and hang out with me.
Okay.
And that was great. And it was, you know, wasn't like it was hard for him to be present physically. Because you think about it, you're talking about 6.5 weeks mm-hmm. full-time being in the hospital.
That's even hard to comprehend, you know, like imagine.
Yeah, it's really, it's a room. Own universe.
And not just being, but the mm-hmm. fear, I would imagine, of like every moment, every movement. Is this it? Is this...
Not only was I in bed, there were times where I wasn't allowed to leave the bed, and I was tilted backwards so that my feet were elevated using gravity to try to kind of slow things down. Because nobody really knows why preterm labor starts. Nobody really knows how to stop it. We've got these medications called tocolytic medications that sometimes seem to work to slow contractions. I was on a number of them. Some of them are miserable, like magnesium sulfate. Anybody who's been on MAG knows, you know, you can't, you feel like a 2-ton rag doll, hot. They don't let you get out of bed because you'll fall.
Wow.
What it does is it relaxes all the spoon muscle in the body. The idea is it's trying to stop the contractions of the uterus, which is muscle.
Right.
You know, and whether it was because of the medication, whether it was because of being in the bed, whether I would have had contractions all those weeks and nothing would have happened till 30 weeks anyway, nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the idea of giving birth to twins that early was then and still is a scary proposition. You know, the outcomes, you know, mortality and morbidity are really variable, you know, so it's a scary, scary proposition.
And even though, you know, as you're talking about the physical aspects of everything you're going through in the EMDR world, I'm just thinking what was going on emotionally and psychologically for you at that time?
I was really terrified all the time. And you had asked about my husband, you know, he always had a very pragmatic approach to things. And so, you know, if there was something to be worried about or concerned that he needed to pay attention to, he wanted to know. But I think it was hard for him to really kind of feel into what I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. I don't think he really understood the depth of my anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I think it was really hard for him. I know it was hard for him to understand the physicality of what I was experiencing.
Right.
Just like that I'm laying in a bed on an IV drip of magnesium, feel like garbage, you know, I've got, you know, cold compresses on my head to try to cool me off. I've been NPO for days. I couldn't eat anything the first few days because they didn't know if they were going to have to take me in for a crash C-section at any moment. So they were trying to slow the labor down with the idea that, like, we don't know how long this pregnancy is going to last. And I don't think you can know what that's like.
Right. Well, how could you?
Or anybody could know.
Right.
But you know, the only time he ever really looked scared to me was the night that I spiked a fever, and the team couldn't decide if I had a pulmonary embolism or a uterine infection. And so they were doing it. I was on an oxygen mask, and they were going to do an amnio. What they do is they do an amnio on the lower lying baby to see if there's infection. I was in this tiny room. It was like the size of a walk-in closet. I was single room across from the nurse's station. And there were probably 8 people in that room and an ultrasound machine. And he walked in as they were getting set up. And that was the first time, maybe the only time, he looked really like, oh my God, what's going on here? Because I think probably just the scene itself conveys some of that, oh no.
Right.
But I was living with that, oh no, all the time. I wasn't feeling the contractions, but I could see the monitor.
Oof.
So, you know, I wanted to get as far as I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we, you know, as a couple, you know, we had really had to talk. I was 24 weeks, I think, in 3 days when that happened. So it was very, very, very early. And they, you know, if I had had a uterine infection, they would have had to deliver the babies, because at that point, it's not better for them to be inside. It's better for them to be outside, even early. Turned out I didn't have either one of those things, by the way. Had a fever, didn't have either one. But, you know, but those, you know, this talk, you know, this conversation about what if was pretty profound. You know, what will happen if one or two, both babies die? What will happen if there's medical fragility forever? What if there's developmental disability? What if there's, you know, there's so many things.
Well, I would also imagine there was also the conversation of, well, if your health didn't survive.
Well, so that was interesting, because the other thing that could have, the other differential they had was pulmonary embolism. Now, apart from being on mag sulfate, I felt fine.
Right.
I was healthy. The only thing that was happening was my uterus wouldn't stop contracting early. And I remember having this conversation with everybody saying, listen, if I had to choose, I choose a pulmonary embolism because I'm strong and healthy and they can treat me. I don't want these babies to have to be born. And nobody around me was particularly impressed with that argument.
Shocking.
But it was interesting. Looking back on it now is interesting, because it was very clear to me that, and I think this is very much a thing that happens, part of maybe protective parenting. Mm-hmm. Like, listen, if there's something that I can do that will protect my children, that I can handle, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I already had started, you know? And luckily it wasn't, there was no pulmonary embolism. It's one of those stories that comes out of like a really bad novel. It was midnight and I'm being wheeled to the basement of the hospital to go to radiology to get this lung.
It was, oh
like,
my gosh.
I'm like, this is a terrible, it's like basement. Literally the middle of the night. Basement of
nothing
the hospital.
Ever happens good in a basement.
No, not in any of the stories. They don't. This one was okay. But it was like out of a horror movie. The feeling that was really surreal.
And did you, you know, and we talk a lot about this in therapy and in trainings, how did you feel you were being treated as the birth mom, like, and as a woman? And
I was a body.
Okay.
At one point I said to one of the nurses, do I need to be running up and down the hall pulling out my IV for me to get some psychological support? And she paused and she was like, well, maybe that'll do it.
Oh.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. And by the time we got to the NICU, at one point I said to their neonatologist, who was a wonderful doctor and a very caring, paternalistic person, I said to him, I am going to come back at some point and explain this to you, why this is so hard. Because they mean well, and yet there really are gaps in medical education and in psychological education. Mm-hmm. And the social worker who came in once I was stabilized on bed rest said, "This must be so hard." And I'm waiting. That was all she had, pretty much.
Ooh, I mean, Hallmark cards have more than that. Like, that was pre hashtags, but we could have come up
pretty
with
much,
something.
Pretty much, like, not much.
Wow.
Not much there. Yeah. So it was really isolating, and I was dying for someone to talk to. I was dying for people to talk to people who'd been through it. I was dying to read something. And really what I got was this very paternalistic, protective attitude when I was still pregnant. One of the NICU nurses said, "Well, when you get to 30 weeks, we'll give you stuff to read." I thought, really? When I was 26 24. Weeks. So I was hospitalized at 24 weeks. This was probably at maybe 26 or 27. When I was 26 weeks, I asked one of my nurses, who's the one who had actually admitted me that day that I was hospitalized, finally had the guts to say to her, "What do 26 weekers look like?" And she said, you could see her freeze. And she said, "Small." And then she ran out of the room. And I'm like, pretty sure I knew that part. Pretty sure I knew that. But imagine the how much it takes to finally ask the question.
Right?
Like, what could I expect if I delivered today?
Right.
So, you know, I think that we need to think about how do we support the medical provider and the psychotherapy provider in not being scared of these questions, in recognizing what this experience is like for families. And it varies, right? Not everybody's bed rest experience is the same. Not everybody's preterm birth experience is the same. And that's just one slice of perinatal crisis, right? There's so many different kinds of things that can happen that are traumatizing in the perinatal period, different kinds of losses. But you know, it's like everybody knows the big rocks, right? But it's all the pebbles and the sand that get missed.
And then all the small moments too, the fear, the panic,
all of it. That's,
and
yeah,
then the constant sand. Adrenaline, you know, of going into your body. And how did it unfold from there?
Ah, so they were born at 10 weeks early. They spent 10 weeks in the NICU. And their NICU course was, you know, again, looking back, relatively smooth, but they did come home with oxygen and apnea monitors.
Okay.
And that was another, that felt like the hospital was following me.
Okay.
Coming home, they needed it. And then a couple months after they came home, those were discontinued. And, you know, then the journey really begins. Because, you know, the medical team says things like, go home and treat them like a regular baby. We can unpack that sentence for a while.
Right.
But the reality is that, you know, they tell you to adjust for the prematurity. So a baby born 8 weeks early, when they're 8 weeks old, is considered, you know, sort of newborn age, corrected age. Like, you don't expect newborn, full-term newborn behavior from a baby born 2 months early until they've developed to that point. So my kids came home 10 weeks after they were born. They were 10 weeks early. So they came home as if they were newborns, but they were smaller than newborns. They were 5 pounds each.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they had been through a journey.
Right.
They weren't newborns.
Right. I mean, lots of trauma. I mean, even
lots of trauma.
The whole trauma. Right.
And it's really profound how much trauma. Like, we fear it. We know, well, yeah, maybe. But, you know, we hear like, so I spent years then afterwards, once I found my community of people, interviewing parents and with another psychologist, a wonderful now dear friend, co-writer, colleague, partner in crime, Debbie Davis. We've written several books together. We've created several workshops as well for clinicians. But we spent years interviewing parents. Mm. So you hear the stories about the babies that flinch if you tear tape, or, you know, if they smell like rubbing alcohol, right? So any of those sensory cues, right?
Yeah.
Flinching, right? You hear that, but actually it's even more profound than that. In terms of like what the the fetus experiences and then what the newborn experience, this premature newborn experiences. And it's not just preemies, anybody in the NICU, any infant in the NICU, even full term. The assault on the nervous system, the medical interventions, and the separation from parents is really profound. And, you know, we're working, we meaning the neonatal community, you know, making progress. You know, in the 26 years since my girls were born, we've come a long way in how NICUs are even designed, in, you know, recognizing the role of parents in some places as part of the healthcare team. Mm-hmm. You know, we are part of the team. Mm-hmm. I don't want the doctor's job. I don't want the nurse's job. I have a job.
Great.
A space for me to do my job as the parent on this team. But that doesn't get, it's not universally understood.
Right.
In some places it is. And in some places it's deeply understood. You know, family integrated care, you know, as a model, NIDCAP care, which is the individualized, really neuroprotective care. But my kids were born in 96 in a unit that looked like a barn kind of setup, not lots of wood, but like bed, fluorescent lights, all the machine. It was all the monitors stacked up back to back. So there was one bay and then another bay. Mm-hmm. And so you could hear all the monitors all the time.
Wow.
And they had an overhead announcement system. So if they needed, you know, paging Dr. So-and-so blaring from the ceiling, right? With these little tiny babies with immature right. nervous systems, unmyelinated nervous systems,
right.
some really sick, you know, intubated babies, babies with infections, babies with brain bleeds, babies with, you know, so many things. So it was a lot of stimulus. You know, a few weeks in, I was ready to lose my mind from the right. stimulus. I can only imagine what babies felt.
If you don't mind me asking, there just one thing that popped into my mind of when I'm listening to your story is, what did you, you know, as we talk about healing and, you know, all of a sudden, now you're parents and now you have to deal with all of that. Where was the role of anger in all of this for you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Anger has always been hard for me, much better now as I'm older, and the more therapy work I do, the better access I have to healthy anger. I felt much more shame and much more fear. I got angry at extended family members sometimes for how they asked questions or the kinds of things. Or a family member who called and was asking in this very kind of anxiety pitched way, all kinds of questions, needing me to kind of support them. And I really felt like throwing the phone at the wall.
Right.
I got really angry. And a little bit angry at the doctors when they didn't listen to me. But it's scary to get angry at your healthcare team. Because you have to go home and they're taking care of your very, very tiny
They're fragile your kids. Lifeline.
Yeah.
And your babies.
Yeah. So it would come in, you know, more specific moments.
Okay. And your husband?
I think he would get mad at me being anxious.
Oh, typical couples.
Yep. Like impatient, I think, with my I needed to know everything. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to understand everything. And I wanted to understand why things were happening.
Right.
And he really was like, when there's something for me to worry about, let me know. Which made me feel very alone.
It's not like wrestling where I'm just going to tag you in, like you're
right, already, exactly. You're already yeah, let me know when you need me. Yeah,
you're already here,
Brad. He always thought they would be okay. I mean, that was the thing. He wasn't anxious for somebody who was actually anxious about lots of other things.
Right.
He wasn't anxious about the outcome.
Do you think part of that was because you were okay?
That's interesting. Maybe.
And the reason I'm wondering is because, you know, part of, as you talked about, there's so many slices to this.
Yes.
And I think what struck me is really powerful when you were saying, let the problem be with me. I'm strong. I can handle it. And you're in that. And then your partner might be saying, you know, when you have, what would you do if mm-hmm. you have to decide, or when couples have to decide,
yeah.
you know, and the male partner's like, protect my female partner at all times, you know, stereotypically speaking. And the birth parent is always like, save the baby.
Yeah. Yeah. And this happens with grandparents too, you know, and my mother said to me, you know, I worry about the babies, but I worry about you. You're my baby.
Right. Right.
So, you know, everybody in that constellation is standing with a different point of view.
Right.
And
fear and anger and anxiety of how do we, and loss of control.
Yeah.
And powerlessness, which then, as we know, triggers all sorts of interesting coping skills and resourcing. Yeah. Some adaptive, yeah. Some not.
I'm not so adaptive.
Like getting mad at your wife who just went through hell because yeah. she's worried. I mean,
I'm anxious, right?
But let's get mad at her because that's going to make it better.
Yeah. Well, you
love,
know,
right? Love.
That's it. Right. So messy. So much messy.
Well, and you can correct me if I'm way off here, Mara, too. The And this may seem inconsequential, but the other part to what I was thinking is, it, not only are you experiencing all of this trauma and all of this fear and all of this worry, and you want to be safe, but you want your babies to come in and be safe. The joy and the celebration was stolen.
Totally.
And that, I think, for me would be a whole other discussion of grief. Because that's when, you know, like nesting and having the parties and doing all these things. And
oh,
then,
yeah. And not even when you come home, because you have to isolate.
Right.
Because,
right.
you know, those preemies coming home are very, very vulnerable. And we came home in the middle of August, and RSV season starts, you know, in the fall in the Midwest. And RSV kills preemies.
Right.
It's a common cold virus.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned that because when I was growing up, I don't remember ever hearing about it. And then the last year, the cases in this area have just exploded.
Yeah, so there was a huge spike in RSV this winter. And, you know, it's been complicated because of the pandemic as well, just in terms of we don't know why there's actually been, it's not that there's been more RSV cases, it's that the acuity is higher.
Okay.
More kids have been ending up in the hospital.
Well, and adults as well.
And adults. You
know, it would just...
Right, and what has COVID done to our immune systems?
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of things we haven't enough time with this virus to know
right.
yet. And, you know, so, but so, you know, so, but, you know, you're isolated when you're in the NICU. A lot of NICUs, certainly 26 years ago, had very restrictive visiting policies.
Mm.
The fact that they referred to parents as visitors is very telling. And they still refer to parents as visitors. Yeah. Like, not a visitor, I'm a parent. I'd stay here all the time if I could.
Right.
Go to bed for me. But they didn't want any, they wouldn't let anybody else come in. So, like, we didn't have family in town. We lived in Chicago. Parents lived in other parts of the country. So, grandparents came to visit. We had to negotiate to let them onto the unit to see the babies. You know, it was very, you know, only two at the bedside. You can understand, look, it's an ICU and they're very careful about infection. NICUs have become, pandemic aside, pandemic made it, again, even more restrictive, where two parents couldn't come in at the same time, only one at a time, just really infection control. And it's understandable. Much more thoughtful about letting parents bring in meaningful people to meet their babies. Because this is the thing, you've got these babies and it's like, theoretically, like nobody's met them.
Right.
Nobody can meet them. You have these babies for 10 weeks and like, who's seen them but us?
Right. And then
they come home and then same thing.
And all of that anxiety and stress and worry and every minutia in every detail of just is on you and your partner.
Yeah.
Of everything.
Right. All the conversations with the doctors. And we really were lucky in that there weren't major complications.
Right.
You know, a lot of my fellow preemie parents had much more complex experiences in the NICU with major kinds of life and death decisions that they needed to make. I mean, we had serious stuff we needed to think about. We had, you know, they were intubated, they were on, you know, other kinds of respiratory support. They had, you know, blood transfusions and IV medications and, you know, monitoring for they had steroids, you know. But again, kind of boring as NICU experiences go in terms of what could have been, thank God, you know, really could mm-hmm. have been much worse. But when you're living it, it's terrifying.
Right. And as you're saying this, you know, just as a reminder to all of us who are listening is remember 26 years ago, right? Yeah, so no cell phones. No,
no
internet in the room. Like there's no,
oh,
oh
no.
Let me listen to a podcast. Let me text. Let me call.
Nothing.
Like no, like
nothing.
The isolation of just, you know, people freak out when they have to leave their phone for TSA or turn it off in the movies.
Right.
6.5 weeks.
6.5 weeks.
I can't even imagine, you know, just the ramifications of that on your system and then trying to probably counteract that. So it's not pumping into the little ones.
It was interesting. The only therapeutic intervention they sent was there was a, in the chaplaincy department, there was a music therapy student who played the harp.
Oh.
And she had a portable harp. And she would come in a couple times a week and play the harp. And that was great.
Wow.
That was great. And she even came in and played once the girls were in the NICU once or twice.
That's amazing.
And I found a CD of the same music that she'd been playing. So I played it for them in their nursery.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was really cool.
What was it like once they got home and stabilized?
Well, they were home on oxygen, and
okay.
That was ridiculous because you're tethered all the time. And, you know, the apnea monitor stickers would rip up their skin. It was hard.
Right.
I was so glad to have them home, but it was really hard. You know, I'm pumping and I'm nursing and I'm trying to, you know, feed them. And, you know, we got some help, which was life-saving. And it's scary. You know, people want to come see them. Family members want to come see them. And it's like, if you have a cold, stay away.
Mm-hmm.
You can't come in here unless you wash your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really wash your hands. Like, so when the pandemic started, it was really funny because, you know, my whole preemie parent community was like, we've got this.
That's
everybody,
awesome.
Stop.
Yes.
Because we understood, what does it mean to keep a distance in order to protect somebody that you
right.
love?
Right.
What do you, you know, how to scrub up? You know, you don't walk into a NICU until you scrub.
Right.
Like you
said before
surgery with the brushes and the whole thing. Scrub. These are fragile immune systems. And they're still fragile when they come home. So there was, it was isolating the first year, and exhausting, but it got better. First time we went to the pulmonologist, my mom was still helping. She was able to come for a couple of weeks and help. And so we went for a follow-up with the pulmonologist. They were still on oxygen. And I was so hoping they were going to be able to get off the oxygen. And we go in, she takes them off. She puts them on the pulse oximeter, which measures oxygen saturation. She takes them off the oxygen and, you know, reach holding a baby. And after a couple of minutes, the alarms start to beep because the oxygen is dropping. They couldn't keep their oxygen sats up yet. It has to do with how they're breathing, how deeply they're breathing. Just weren't mature enough. And I lost it. And the doctor, sweet, such a sweet woman, she kept saying, they're okay. They're going to be okay. They're going to be okay. And my mother looked at her and said, but she's not.
Yeah, right. It's almost like as if they forgot about you.
And so the doctor was like, okay. And by the time we left, we had some home nursing.
Wow.
And so that was actually quite helpful because that meant that I had a professional. I don't remember. I think we had a few hours every week. We could divide it however we wanted. We had two babies. So we had a bunch of hours that we could spread out. Right. What that meant is I had a trained professional eyeballing them every day.
Right, right.
Which lowered my anxiety considerably.
Right. And does that happen today, do you find, in your experience working with parents that are dealing with this? Like, I'm just thinking parents of resources, or if you're in rural areas, or, you know, when you said 30 minutes for the hospital, I'm like, what if, you know, 2.5 hours or so, you know, like all the variations parents have to deal with.
Right. It varies a lot in the U.S. and around the world. You know, it just depends on where you live, depends on what kind of insurance the country has or the family has, what's accessible to them, you know, and healthcare has changed a lot in 25 years.
Right.
So, you know, we had decent insurance and that made a big, big, big difference. Although, you know, as a young, I was 28, I think. So like you get an EOB for the first time, you don't. You're like, is this a bill?
Yeah.
Like, what? It's thousands of dollars. Right. What? You know, it's really scary.
Yes.
So, you know, hospitals should have resources built in, but hospitals are going to vary in how sophisticated those resources are. You know, hospital social workers presumably are there and able to help with resources and hooking people up, but it's regional. It just depends on what's available. Not even state to state, but even regionally within a state.
And I was also thinking too of what you were sharing, in the sense of you were sort of just the body. And so enter, you know, 26 years later, like when I am in the field now and hearing these stories and all of my colleagues that work with perinatal related issues, and you're still hearing the same thing. It's discouraging, a little mindful of where the birth parent is still being treated like a body. And the one thing that I hear over and over again is when there's that statement, something's wrong, something doesn't feel right. And we talked about that in another episode together, of that invalidation and that, well, you're oversensitive or you're crazy or you're too emotional or you're just doing that thing, mm-hmm. instead of listening, something's wrong.
Something's wrong. And it's so true when it comes to your own body. It's also true for parents' observations of their babies. Mm. So in a NICU setting, the parent is the continuous variable.
Right.
Even in hospitals that have what we call primary nursing, where there's a collection of nurses that when they're working, work with the same sets of babies. So they get to know the baby, they get to know the family gets to know them, which is really the way to do it. You know, it's better healthcare mm-hmm. when you have primary care nursing as opposed to a stranger every day. Stranger three times, two right. or three times a day.
Right.
But the parent is the continuous variable. You know, for again, not every parent can be at the hospital every day, all day. Parents have to go back to work. Parents have older children. But even so, you know, that parent knows their child.
Right.
And so when a parent says something's not right, this is part of being part of the healthcare team.
Right.
I know my baby. And when parents are dismissed, it's damaging on every level you can imagine, because parents can sometimes pick up something that the monitors haven't yet picked up, or notice something happening that the nurses say, well, that's just the nurses will often say things like, it's a preemie thing.
Mm.
And it's
that
and
was
it's,
sent me over the edge if someone sent it.
Me
I'd be like, well, now I'm an angry thing. So now it's you
now,
and me.
Now
and
I'm
thing.
An angry thing. Exactly.
Now it's me and you thing.
Yeah. Right. And like, okay. And so what does that mean? And what are right. the implications of that?
Well, and also, sorry, my mind just jumped to too many questions. Okay. So let me just rephrase what I was going to say of, how do you, I'm just trying to think of like maybe in the medical profession, like that mentality of it's a preemie thing. Like, you know, it's, they have to be black and white, right? It has to be that critical.
Well, and they
thing.
See this sort of stuff all the time and they're right. not alone.
And how do you differentiate in your experience when it is the intuition and yeah. maybe there's mental health stuff going on?
I think it's the difference between responding and reacting. So when there is something that a parent is saying, my baby doesn't usually do this. So like the story I often tell in trainings is about one of the twins, they were about a month old, a lot of preemies have, we call them A's and B's, apnea and bradycardia. So apnea is when there's a temporary holding of the breath. They stop breathing for a moment. And a bradycardia is a heart rate drop. It's usually secondary to apnea. It has to do with the immature brainstem. For whatever reasons, neither of my kids did that. They didn't have A's and B's. They just didn't. They needed oxygen, but they didn't have these episodes. Like, you know, they need to, okay. But all of a sudden, one day, one of the kids, her oxygen saturation kept dropping. Drop, 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 big tap. You know, she wasn't holding, you know, wasn't apnea, wasn't bradycardia. Drop, drop, drop. And it was weird. That was not a thing that would happen with her. Her oxygen stayed the same. You couldn't wean her off the oxygen, but her sats were good.
Okay.
Her saturation levels were good. Okay. I'm sitting at the bedside all day long getting more and more anxious. Something's wrong. Something, this is not normal. Right. And the nurse says it's a preemie thing. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. And also, she's been a preemie for a month and she's never done it. So what is this, a 1-month-old preemie thing?
Right. Is there a guideline here? Can I get a book?
Yeah, could you give me a timeline?
Is there a pamphlet?
Oh, there's a pamphlet. They're useless. So finally, and this was a big deal because I'm a rule follower. I'm very compliant. And like I said, it's scary to get angry at your care providers. So I went to the charge nurse and I said, can you page our neonatologist? The way it works in the NICU is it's a very, you know, like I see most ICUs, the doctors rotate, mm-hmm. like who's on the unit during the day. Ours was a 3-week rotation. So they were about a month old. So the doctor who'd been the one on the unit when they were born, he followed them till discharge, but he was not anymore the doctor who walked in every day and did rounds.
Right.
He was now doing another thing because they would rotate. But I could page him because he was still in the hospital.
Right.
We'd page our doctor. Sure. Then change of shift for nurses happened and they kicked parents off the unit, which is a whole nother conversation. And I'm in the parent room pacing. Doctor comes, doctor, I don't know, telling me, we don't want to intervene too quickly. We're watching. I said, I don't want you to intervene. I just want you to diagnose. Something is not right. And I burst into tears. And when I opened my eyes, the man was gone. Gone. So I'm like, okay. So about 10 minutes later, up comes his resident. We're going to do an x-ray. 20 minutes later comes back. He's like, oh, she's got some pulmonary edema, which means some fluid in the lungs. And in that moment, I'm like, I know. I told you something was wrong.
Right.
Now, thankfully, this wasn't life-threatening, right? This wasn't a medical, it wasn't a crisis.
But how many cases do we hear where it is?
Right. And also, I don't want her oxygen saturation dropping. Hello?
Right.
She has many organ systems that need oxygen.
Right. Like it's like it's just a little blood. The cut's not that bad.
Just
walk it off.
Don't waste oxygen. Oxygen is too much oxygen. It's well, toxic. Hello.
And then also, I'm just thinking, you know, you're still deprived as the parent because of everything your body's going through, and now you're having to find the internal strength to challenge and push back people who are supposed to be on your team.
Well, right, and in a system that I'm just learning.
Right. That you were, right. As you said, if you're compliant and follow the rules, what do we grow up learning? It's like you listen to the doctor, you do what the doctor said, you don't question the doctor.
Exactly.
But so, now it's, oh, I'm questioning everything.
Everything. So it was interesting, though, because from an identity perspective, it didn't feel like parental intuition at that time. It felt like the old me looking and saying something's different here.
Okay.
Figure it out. You know, it was like, well, this is the clinician me.
Right.
You know, and it takes time for parents to develop a sense of self as parent that feels legitimate. Because parents get dismissed.
Right.
So my parent intuition gets like flicked away. But if I'm a peer, I'm also a clinician. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Listen. I'm telling you something's different.
Mm-hmm.
Don't dismiss it. So, you know, there's so much development that happens in a perinatal crisis. And like I said, you know, the NICU is one example, but, you know, certainly an illustrative one.
Right. Mara, do you Do you have a feeling or a belief as to why this isn't talked about more? Or, I mean, you and I have had this conversation before where in our education, like in my grad program, and this was never discussed. I don't know if I ever heard the word until I was in the field for a long time. I remember being in high school and learning, health classes and all of that, but there was never ever discussions about anything perinatal related. Just basically, this is how you don't get pregnant, in one way or another, or this is how you do get pregnant, or this is an STD. Right. But none of this, why do you think that is? That there, it's so.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, it's not like other medical crises that a person can go through their whole life and never come across and never experience. Reproductive life, reproductive period is everywhere. Whether it's you personally, your partner, your family, your own parents, your own siblings, experience, birth, being born experiences. Like if you look around, it's like really everywhere. So I don't know whether it's like, if we don't talk about it, we don't have to think about it.
Kind of like, let's not talk about Bruno.
Let's not talk about Bruno. Let's not talk about Bruno.
Right.
We'll set a place for him, but we weren't going to talk about him.
Right. And we can hear him. I'm sorry. I just got to go in my little soapbox. You heard him for 10 years.
Yes. Yes, you did.
Sorry. Pull it in, Patrick. No.
That's it.
Not the time and place.
You know what? It's a great analogy because there is an element of knowing and not knowing at the same time.
Right.
People will talk about going in for their 20-week scan and to make sure everything's okay. Mm-hmm. So there's an awareness there that maybe everything isn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Going to the doctor, getting, the initial blood tests. So there's an implicit awareness that things don't always go well. But when you're telling your birth story, birthing mothers very commonly will, come into a huddle and be, sharing their birth stories. Well, when you have a traumatizing birth, a preemie birth, a stillbirth, who are you supposed to tell your birth story to? These people don't necessarily want to hear your birth story unless they're dear friends and really do make space for it. In your average group of, parents and kids hanging out, you don't want to hear my birth story.
Do you feel, and I've just seen this in other areas of mental health, do you feel that sometimes people feel like it's almost contagious?
I think
like,
when
oh, she had
other yeah. pregnant people, I think it's really scary.
Okay.
And I do think that there is some sensitivity that's important. Now I'm 26 years past this experience, the moments of the experience. But, if I'm talking to a pregnant person, I'm not going to delve into my birth story with the pregnant person,
right.
However, a lot of times after a traumatic birth, a preemie birth, stillbirth, a lot of people are like, nobody told me this was possible. Now, some people may have never read about or heard about the kinds of things that can happen, and there's many things that can happen beyond the ones that we all do hear about. And so it's tricky, how to talk to people in the reproductive period about the kinds of things that can happen in a pregnancy and a birth, the kinds of things that can happen without terrifying people. But how to make space for different experiences and different journeys. Because, the journey doesn't end when the baby comes home.
Right.
The preemie or medically fragile baby. There's in my bio, I say very intentionally, raising those NICU grads.
Right.
Those NICU grads are 26.
Right.
And they're still NICU grads.
Right.
They're incredible. And they are 26-year-old preemies.
Right.
Don't stop being preemies just because you sent them home.
Right. And how did that affect them?
So they were far, so I have identical twins.
Okay.
So for my particular children, they were far more in terms of identity into the twin thing.
Did they have the twin magic?
Yes.
Or they have it, sorry.
They do, yes. And okay. The preemie thing, yeah, they're very close. They depend on each other. For many, people couldn't tell them apart. You know, the whole twin thing.
Could you, though? Could you always tell them apart?
Always.
Okay, and their dad?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I can always tell them apart in pictures.
Okay.
He couldn't always tell them apart in pictures.
Okay.
I can look at a picture and tell you who's who. And I can tell you how I know, but it doesn't seem to help anybody else. But it's actually only recently that they have been both more interested and more receptive to talking about their preemie birth and their NICU stay. They were really not terribly interested in it. They've seen their pictures. We talked about it. They've heard me talk about it. So it's not like it wasn't talked about, but they just didn't. They're like, yeah, whatever. Kind of vaguely interesting in a distant sort of way. But recently, as you know, as they, as young adults, have grappled with various components of sequela from having been preemies, from the steroid exposure in utero, the steroid exposure in the NICU, which really, you know, if you look at the outcome literature, what you see is like, it sort of magnifies whatever genetic vulnerabilities were already there.
Okay.
You know, you see higher rates of, right, you know, social anxiety, generalized anxiety, ADHD, learning disabilities, on and on. So, you know, there are these very common sequela that you see. And of course, every individual's expression of that is going to be different. But as I've done, now I spent the first probably 10 years of their lives researching and writing these books for parents of premature babies.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the last several years have been working again with Debbie Davis to develop workshops for clinicians. And so I've delved more into the literature, you know, the
research.
The research, the outcome literature, all kinds of stuff, and started talking to them about what I'm seeing, which very familiar to me. Nothing was a surprise, but it's there's something about seeing, you know, the numbers, right? Starting to talk to them about their experiences and really about the things that are hard for them today are without question sequela from their prematurity.
Wow.
And not their fault.
Right.
And that is not a new message. This is not your fault.
Right.
But I think at this age and stage, they each are hearing it and taking it in more fully. And one of my kids recently, she wanted to, and I got her in to do some early trauma work, EMDR, early trauma protocol work. And I'm part of that therapy because it's done remotely. And I have permission to tell this story.
Okay.
because I do the tapping because you tap on the ankles.
Okay.
And I'm also there because I can fill in the blanks. You know, early trauma protocol begins before you were even conceived, through pregnancy, birth, through the first 2 years. So it's this like before you have narrative memory kind of experience. And so it was just last week, actually, that one of my preemies was reprocessing the in utero experience, and birth, you know, sort of the in utero birth, NICU, early NICU. And what was coming up for her was, it's my fault that we're born early. And so that was the first piece, and that got able to correct and say, no, here's what was actually happening.
Right.
And it was, you know, because of this anatomical thing or that anatomical thing, nothing, you guys were healthy, you were fine, nothing wrong with either of you. And then, you know, because what you do is you go back and see what's left, right? Like always with the MDR. And then what was coming up was, looking at this baby in the NICU, And she was having these feelings of sort of contempt for this baby, for needing, not sort of, I don't know, not being able to be, I don't know what. It's some, like something's wrong with you. You suck. Right. You suck, right. Babe. You suck. And then, you know, processing through that with a little bit of also just psychoed in the moment about what babies need. And part of the early trauma protocol is imagine the baby getting, because, you know, here are the nurses or running around and mom and dad couldn't be there all the time. I was there all day, but I couldn't be there all night.
Right.
All these. And so part of the protocol is to imagine that baby getting, little baby getting all of the attunement, all the attentiveness, all of that. So process, process, process. And at the end, it's feeling really empathic to this baby. And she really is doing the, you know, what she needed to do. This particular twin would, whenever they would come, the nurses would come to take her temperature and change her diaper and, you know, do vitals, you know, check their, they would check head circumference and abdomen. She would kick and scream and yell. Okay. You're bothering me!
Get out.
Yes, get, go away. You know, and so like really coming to appreciate that baby and tap, 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 tap. We're doing all this processing. Beautiful work, wonderful. So this was Thursday night. So tonight, she looks at me and she says, I feel way better since that session. I said, really? She said, yeah, you know, there are so many things that happen day to day where my automatic reaction is something like you suck to herself.
Oh, wow.
And she said, oh, just like breaks a mother's heart, of course. And she said, but it's like, not happening. She said, I keep throwing things at it. Like she's trying to provoke the reaction. Right. Like it's not there.
Wow.
And I'm doing the like EMDR happy. Yeah, man,
right.
Right. And I said, that's the difference between having to learning to manage something and actually putting the fire out.
Yes. Yes.
But what's so profound to me is that I would never have, I knew, which is why I wanted her to have early trauma protocol, EMDR, that it had to be that where she was still stuck in things had to be that early because she's worked so hard.
Right.
And we as a family, you know, we've done all the other things that we can possibly do. But, you know, there's something so early, so profound that comes from the experience of that helplessness, that experience of like all the stimulus coming in, you know, and it's like, it's not even a thought. It's just a felt sense of yes. I must stop in some way and danger. I'm in danger and I just suck. And now it's just like, I keep poking at it and I can't, it's like not having that response.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Right. Right. And inspiring. And that she was able to go there.
Yeah. Well, she's an incredible human being. And persistent as anything. And, you know, will just do what it takes. I feel, you know, so much grief that I didn't know 20 years ago to do this. I mean, I was first trained in EMDR 20 years ago. You know, I didn't have the knowledge and the resources to know how best to address what sequela might have been. And I didn't know enough then, even as a child psychologist, about how subtle some of these trauma impacts are. And so, you know, my passion, and it's been my passion for a long time now, but more and more to educate fellow clinicians, both the perinatal clinicians and the trauma-focused clinicians who don't, you know, to educate the perinatal clinicians about trauma-focused work and the EMDR clinicians about perinatal work so that people like my kids don't fall through the cracks anymore.
Right. And it's interesting that you say that too. Of, I've never been connected to, if people have heard the term like big T, little T trauma, like the classification of trauma.
Yeah,
right. I never felt aligned with that because it just never felt, it, you know, it's like, to me, it's like trauma is a wound is a wound is a wound. And, you know, I think we see that a lot when people, when we talk about trauma and we introduce that to people, and we're talking about the AIP model, the adaptive informational processing that's part of EMDR. And people say, well, I don't have trauma. I wasn't at the, 9/11. I wasn't assaulted. My parents loved me. It's like, but then when you change it a little bit and you say, well, it's a wound or an injury. And
injury, yeah, that's what I used to. Right. Rupture.
Rupture. And then that can be, and what's humbling for me as a clinician is to be able to see when I hear the stories of, oh, their rupture, their injury was in those subtle moments, was not always something happening, but sometimes something not happening.
Yes, absolutely. And in the most profound, horrible scenarios, it's pervasive neglect.
Right.
But doesn't have to be pervasive neglect,
right?
Right? That baby in the NICU where the staffing is just a little too tight, and that baby's crying just a little too long, too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, we don't need perfect parenting. We don't need perfect nursing. We don't need, we need good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the realization of the particular vulnerabilities of a neonate and of a premature neonate or a medically fragile, even full term neonate, is just so important, and again, the separation from parent is also really key, because the adaptive environment is baby and parent together.
Right.
The separation is toxic, and we want to mitigate that as much as possible.
As we kind of wind down, I just had a quick, what is another way that you explain adaptive to people? Because it's a clinical term that not everyone may relate to.
Right. So I think of adaptive in a few different dimensions. I think of adaptive, first of all, as the best someone can do in the situation with what they've got. So what's adaptive for me in a horrible situation when I'm 10, that same behavior choice may or may not work for me, actually. Protect me, keep me safe, keep me alive, get me through at 20 mm-hmm. or 30, right? So adaptive means it gets me through. But from a clinical perspective, there's also an element of this is information, experience, behavior, knowledge on every dimension, not just intellectual, cognitive, that serves you, that helps you, that makes your situation either fit, settle down, improve. It doesn't always have to be good. It just is, it fits somehow. And so sometimes you can get, the best possible kind of outcome, and that's, the most adaptive. But adaptive also is something that serves development. So for example, sometimes stress is adaptive, meaning it helps shape development in a way that's ultimately helpful. So right. Adaptive doesn't always mean comfortable either.
Right, right. That's wonderful. I really appreciate that. Yeah, that's true. So unfortunately we've run out of time for tonight. So how could people, and I so appreciate this conversation. I could talk to you for hours on this, which we'll have to come back again. How can people connect with you if that, because you're doing a lot of, you got some great projects coming up and a lot of, people connect with you and kind of see, what you're working on?
Well, if people are interested in training in this area, this is my passion. This is the work I most love.
Right.
And, we've mentioned EMDR, but I do training not just for EMDR therapists.
Okay.
I really want people to know, come to the touchstoneinstitute.org and look at the different trainings that we have with people apart from me doing trainings as well. But if you're interested, for example, in learning more about just what is the experience for families and neonates in the NICU, and not just in the NICU, but after discharge,
mm-hmm.
And, once you start to learn about this area, you realize it's everywhere. Debbie and I are going to be doing that training in May. We're doing it live on Zoom. It's also available self-paced all the time.
Right.
And you know, you can find me on the website. You can see what I'm up to. We have, the website was just revamped a few months ago. So we're getting our, you know, our blog going.
Right. And I know you're on social media too. So
I am
and
on
that's
social
all on your website.
On
so.
Facebook. Yes. You can find me on the Touchstone Institute, on Facebook. And if you're an EMDR clinician or interested in EMDR, EMDR and Perinatal Mental Health is a Facebook group that you are most welcome to join, to learn more. And those are the best ways to find me.
Awesome. Wonderful. So my last question is what is one piece of advice or one nugget of knowledge that you would like someone to walk away from our conversation tonight?
I would say that everything that we do clinically with families who've had a perinatal crisis, and we've talked all about NICU, so let's think about NICU, is that precious little should come between parents and their babies, and that parents are part of the healthcare team.
I love that.
And even if you don't work in a hospital setting, that philosophy is developmentally supportive for families, which is adaptive.
Right. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Bring that. You're welcome. Yeah.
So it's been so great having you, Mara. I'm so excited that you were able to come on Friday Night
Thank
Feels.
Thank you for your amazing questions. Really, sure. Really good questions.
And thank you to everyone who watches and listening Friday Night Feels. Just remember, we'll be putting this on the YouTube channel as well as all of the podcast platforms. So please share and like and follow so we can stay in touch. And I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will pick up in a couple weeks with Friday Night Feels. Have a good night, everyone.